You guys know how much I am extremely excited about history in Arizona. You know, we talk about the ancients, but we also talk about Geronimo, and we talk about Mickey Free, and we've discussed all that on here. And so I am so excited that we have a gentleman and his book right here, Apache Wars. Paul Andrew Hutton is going to come and chat with us about history. And I'm going to bring Mr. Hutton in right now. Paul, how are you doing?
I am doing just great. Thanks for having me on.
Man, I'm so excited to have you. We love history, whether it be ancient, whether it be more, you know, a little more modern. We love all of it. It's so great to go to these locations that, you know, are 800 years old, but then you're sitting there with the petroglyphs. It's 1849, somebody getting ready to go to California, the gold rush. And it's just so neat when it all mixes.
Well, it sure is. And of course, out here in the Southwest where we live, the history goes way back, and certainly 12,000 years, and perhaps even longer. Of course, it seems like every week they make a new discovery and push the time frame of when folks were down here further and further back.
You know, we do have a common bond. My daughter just graduated in December. She's a Lobo.
Well, good for her. My goodness, that's great.
So isn't it a small world? I found that. And I do have to ask you this before we get going into serious stuff about some of your movie credits. Oh. Naked Gun. I have to add, I love those. How did that come about that you ended up being in that?
Well, I was out in Hollywood actually working on a screenplay. I had published an article on Davy Crockett, and I'd done a lot of work on Davy Crockett, but I published an article on Davy Crockett in Texas Monthly Magazine that got a lot of press, got a lot of coverage kind of around the country. And David Zucker, who is the writer, director of Airplane, the Naked Gun movies, later did the Scary movies, is a huge Davy Crockett buff. And so he contacted me, and eventually they bought the biography of Davy Crockett that I was just starting to write, and brought me out there to help write a screenplay. So I was out, this was my Hollywood period. I was out there for 2 years, and he was making Naked Gun 33 and a third at the very time that we were writing Davy Crockett. And so we would kind of go back and forth between the set and our office where we were writing. And so he decided to cast me in the movie. And so in the very final scene, I deliver OJ's baby, OJ Simpson's baby. And it really was a pretty amazing experience because I worked with OJ Simpson, of course, and Leslie Nielsen, who was fabulous. OJ's pal, Kardashian, came to the set on occasion. Anna Nicole Smith was in the movie. Of course, Raquel Welch was in the movie. I mean, it had quite a cast, and so it was a big thrill for me as a college professor to be out there. Although the Hollywood scene does wear off on you, it's pretty exciting at first, but you get used to the movie biz. And while I was out there, I started working in television as well. It was just the dawn of the cable era, so I started working for A&E on a show called The Real West. Kenny Rogers, the country singer, was the host. Thing was a big hit, and in fact A&E spun the History Channel off from The Real West and another show that they did, Greystone Productions did, called Civil War Journal. And that's how the History Channel got started, and before you knew it, I'd done 200-300 shows. And before I was finished, started writing and co-producing the shows myself. So that was my TV period. And all during that time, I still had my professor period.
Well, that had to make you pretty popular on campus. You had to be a popular Lobo at that time, I would think.
It was kind of funny, though. In those days, the kids did recognize, you know, some of the kids watched the History Channel and stuff, but they would always tell me what a, you know, big fan dad was or mom was. And but as the years have passed now, it's, you know, my grandfather watched you on TV. He told me about you. You know, guy Methuselah now. You know? So it kind of changed over time. But it was a lot of fun doing all that television. In fact, I just filmed a new show on Western heroes, sort of mountain men types that the Inspiration Network is going to be bringing out next year. So many networks now. It's so amazing. When I started, cable was just absolutely in its infancy in terms of fresh new programming. And now, of course, it's actually almost obsolete as streaming takes over everything.
How'd you end up in New Mexico?
Well, I got my PhD at Indiana University and was looking for a job, and got one at Utah State University and was there for 7 years, and then moved from there to the University of New Mexico just when my first book, Phil Sheridan and His Army, came out. And, I liked Utah State, although life in Utah was unique and interesting, especially up in northern Utah, Cache Valley, where Utah State is pretty isolated. And left there and came down here. Utah State was, of course, the ag school for Utah, and New Mexico is the flagship university for the state of New Mexico. So it was kind of an upgrade. And I've been here ever since.
Did that open your door any at all to the Southwest history being finally, or was that something you were already intrigued with, you know, previously?
Oh, no, I'm totally hooked on the West since I was a kid. In fact, it all goes back to Walt Disney's Davy Crockett when I was a young child, let's put it that way. I would have been 5 years old. And I actually missed Davy Crockett, but I got because we were in England, there was no TV, but we came back to the States in 56, and I got a comic book called Walt Disney's Davy Crockett at the Alamo with Fess Barker on the cover. And oh my goodness, I just loved that. And we had moved to San Angelo, Texas. There's an air base there. My dad was in the Air Force. So we traveled around a lot when I was a kid. And we were there 4 years, and those were very formative years. I went through the first through the fourth grade there, and pretty well was brainwashed with Texas history and fell in love with history altogether. And Davy Crockett and Walt Disney were the source. So that sort of shows where my interest in film and television comes from, because my whole interest in the American West, comes out of popular culture. Of course, in those days, back in the 50s, a third of all of Hollywood's product were Westerns, and Westerns dominated television. There were only three networks, and there were 40 Western TV shows, the late 50s. And so it was a golden age for the Western. And I sure loved the Westerns, loved all the shows, and especially the ones that dealt with history. And I was totally hooked on Western history as a kid. And so I've been very fortunate in being able to follow my childhood fantasies and do it for a living. I mean, I hardly consider it work.
That is awesome. I'll tell you what it's so cool. Reading your book, one thing that really, it was easy. It was like, it was a story, but it just happened to be true. It read to me like a nice fiction story where it was just intriguing and the story was great. And then it was like, and I had to remember, well, wait a minute, this is all real. There's no fiction in this. This book is reading like a book that, is a novel that is fiction, but then you realize that it's not. And that's what I enjoyed about reading. It was such easy reading, and all these characters that I love, you brought to life. And I was fascinated with the way it wrote, because I read a lot of history stuff and most of it's dry, and I tell people, it was a college professor that got me hooked, when he made history real to me. And you did the same thing when I read your book. I was like, wow, this is so incredible that, it's like I read this novel, but man, everything in it's true.
Well, I appreciate that. That was the point. That was exactly what I was trying to do. And this is very different for me as a writer, because I am a college professor and I do live in the academic world, which is a very different world, of course, from the real world outside of the halls of Ivy. And of course, so much academic writing is very dry. And you do have to, when you're doing academic writing, you're writing for a particular audience, and that is essentially your peers. You know, the way I got my job at the University of New Mexico is because I wrote a successful academic book. Now, I think Phil Sheridan and His Army is a good read, but it's light years away from the Apache Wars, where I very consciously focused on narrative, focused on story, focused on character, and really tried to construct it, much like I had constructed television shows I had written in the past, and much like one would construct a novel. And boy, that was a steep learning curve. It was a tough book to write because I had to sort of retrain myself as a writer. And now I can't go back. Now I can't go back to the old way of writing. No way. And I'm working on a new book now called The Undiscovered Country, which is a big history of the West from the French and Indian War to 1900. And that, you know, I'm very consciously writing in exactly the same way. You got to tell a good story. It doesn't do any good to write things that nobody reads. I mean, the academic writing has its place, of course, and popular writers build on the work of academics, and academics have an important role in shaping the consciousness of people about the past, sometimes for ill, other times for good. But I wanted to be a storyteller, and I'd done that in my television work, and I've done it in my magazine writing, and I certainly wanted to do it with that book. So I appreciate that you responded to it in that way.
So with all the stuff out there, you know, of the Southwest history, and even it doesn't matter, East Coast, West Coast, the history is just so unbelievable. I mean, I love history. How did you settle on the Apache Wars?
Well, it's sort of interesting. I am a historian of the military frontier. That's kind of my main area. I'd written on Custer. I'd written on Sheridan, of course, who commanded the army in the West. And I had really sort of avoided the Apaches and really had focused on the Plains Wars, you know, Cheyennes, Arapahoes, Comanches, the Sioux, of course. This was a project that was brought to me by my agent. I got an agent, I have a friend named Jim Donovan, who's a historian in his own right, just had a book come out on the space program. And Jim, in fact, also wrote what I consider to be the very best book on the Battle of the Little Bighorn, about, you know, Custer's last stand. And Jim had approached me and said, you know, they're all excited out in New York because of the success of Empire of the Summer Moon, wonderful book about Quanah Parker and the Comanches. And it become a surprise bestseller and still sells incredibly well today, even though it's been out now, gee, almost 10 years. And so they wanted Indian books. And he said to me, I was actually in California at the time. I remember I took the call. I was in a bookstore in Glendale, California. I took the call and I walked outside and talked to him on the street on my cell. And he said, you know, I just, do you know someone who's a good, solid historian, but also a good writer? And I gave him several names and he didn't like any of them. And so finally I said, well, you know, I guess that's me. And he and I had been discussing another book. I was going to do a joint biography of Wild Bill Hickok and Buffalo Bill, but I wasn't making any progress on it. And he said, well, what do you think about doing the Apaches? And I said, well, all right, here I go. And thus began, my journey, which, at times turned into a nightmare, as writing projects often do. And first I had to write a 65-page proposal to send to New York. And worked very closely with Donovan on that. He was kind of a master of how to put those together. And once it was, that took almost a year. And once it was ready, off it went to New York, and it was like all your dreams come true. Donovan calls me and he says, "Oh my goodness, everyone's crazy about your proposal. I'm going to withdraw it." I said, "Withdraw it? What do you mean?" He says, "They're going to have to bid for it. I'm going to put it up for auction." And so the following week, it went up for auction, and I got an advance beyond my wildest dreams. And of course, then all I had to do was, you know, write the book and make it something that Crown, which the imprint, it's an imprint of Random House, Crown would want to publish. They're the publisher of President Obama's memoir. So a big time New York house, and they had bought the rights to the book. And so off we went to the races, and that began a, 2.5, almost 3 year ordeal. And I had to do a lot of research because this was not an area that I had done a lot of deep digging in. It was an area I was familiar with, but not something that I had researched like I had done the Plains Indians and the Indian Wars on the Northern Plains, especially.
I tell you, the book was fascinating. And so did you spend any time out in the field? I mean, was there a lot of in the field, or was it a combination? How did you kind of prepare yourself for this?
Well, I tried to go to every place that I wrote about. Now, it was impossible to go down to some of the sites in Mexico simply because of the, you know, problems on the border even back then. And but I did visit almost all the sites that I wrote about here in the Southwest. And, you know, it's so important to be on the ground, to get a real feel for what the land is like. You know, and I live out here, of course, and so I have a sense of that. But in this book, nature is one of the major characters. And so you have to have a real feel for nature. And so I have a huge library now of books on the flora and fauna of the Southwest. You know, so I didn't want to make a mistake, you know, on the wrong kind of scrub bush that was going to be in my story. And I really wanted to make the rhythms of life of the Apaches, which are so tied to the natural world around them, understandable to folks. So yeah, I traveled everywhere, and it saved me in one case when I was writing about the famous Bascom affair, which happened because of the kidnapping of young Mickey Free. In my mind, I had things turned around, and by going to the site and standing right there where that old stage station was that had been besieged by the Apaches, suddenly I realized, oh my goodness, I have them going in the wrong direction to hold a, you know, peace parley. And what a terrible mistake that would have been. No one would have had any respect for me if I had done something like that. So I'm a big believer in going, you know, to the places, visiting the sites, getting a real feel for it. And I knew that a lot of my readers would have done the same. They would have gone to these places.
Well, that's kind of what our channel's about, is going out and seeking this history, not only just reading it, but then going out and being in the location. You know, I'm a big, you know, I love all that Civil War. It doesn't matter. You know, I want to be in that place. That guy made that decision, you know, that might've changed the world, or changed his world, at least, you know, finding Geronimo's actual surrender site. We finally, you know, the actual site, you know, and what it would have been like for him to be sitting there, you know, at that time when he actually, you know, was in that location. And that's why I love, you know, we hunted down Kit Carson. Is supposed to be a famous petroglyph, basically his name pecked into a rock in Gila Bend. And we searched for that Freedom Rock for a year, and we found his troop. And it was just amazing to stand there and see these guys rock where they were, you know, that where they were on this rock, even though we didn't find Kit's name, even though I knew he couldn't read or he couldn't write, but we figured somebody did it for him because that's the legend here. But just to be there in that location thinking that, you know, these guys were standing here. And I love that. And when I read your book, I mean, it transports me into that place. And I appreciate that so much.
Well, Kit could scrawl his name. So it is possible to see his name. His name is scrawled on El Moro, you know, the big rock down in near Zuni.
Right.
for sure. And but yeah, he was illiterate, and he couldn't read, and the only thing he could write was indeed his name. What a fabulous life he held, he had, and really sort of the Forrest Gump of the West. You know, he was everywhere, he did everything, was involved in sort of all the aspects of westward expansion, and. And because of that, he's a major character in the new book that I'm working on. Of course, he was a character in Apache Wars as well.
You know, what kind of person went west? What kind of person went west?
Well, people went west for, you know, various reasons. Sometimes you went west to escape. Sometimes you went west to, you know, remake yourself, redefine yourself. And I think that's one of the great appeals of the West, not just in the past, but today as well. So that you can go out to the West and you can become someone else. You can remake yourself, and Americans are great at doing that. And so many people went to the West to try and remake themselves, to start over again. And of course, a lot of people went West for adventure. And of course, many people went West in search of gold, silver, wealth. Some of them found it, most of them didn't. And of course, farmers went West in hopes of, you know, having that dream farm that they always wanted. The same with the ranchers who went west. And of course, there are folks already here, and so that caused a lot of conflict.
You know, the brutality, it seems like a lot of people don't want to deal with that side of this story, but it's so, I mean, it is a part of it. It's part of who we, the brutality of just survival. And not siding with a side is that, you know, it's just, it's the stew. It's everything. It's just part of what happened. And it seems like we're afraid to look at that today. Do you feel that?
Well, I do. And I find it very disturbing. Of course, we seem to be running away from our history. We don't want to, you know, embrace certain aspects of it. And it's almost like, if we can have an enforced amnesia, maybe we'll, maybe it's like it never happened or something, but you know, it's much more important to confront the past with all of its warts, and to try and understand that people on every side of an issue, you know, had their good side as well as perhaps sometimes, you know, bad side. And certainly if you look at someone like Kit Carson, they're very complex. You know, he's a very complex person, and he does these fabulous, wonderful things. But, you know, he's a tough guy. And he's living in a tough land at a tough time. And he does some things that, you know, would horrify us today. Although, frankly, you know, as I look around our country and as I look around the world, I don't see much improvement in the human condition in terms of the way we deal with each other. So I don't really feel very comfortable sitting in judgment on people who lived 150 years ago and then deciding what they were doing was right or wrong. And in Apache Wars, I tried to strike a real balance, and I think I did. I noticed when you come out with a big book like that, of course, you know, it's on Amazon. You read all the Amazon reviews, you know, and there've been like 500 of them, and so I haven't read them all. I finally stopped because people say some pretty nasty things. They seem to believe that somehow they're not connected to what they're writing. That but I got a lot of very positive reviews, but sometimes people would say that, you know, I'm just hopelessly pro-Indian. You know, I'm like D. Brown. This is just another, you know, whitewash of the Indians. And then other people would say that I obviously hated Indians and I was, you know, whitewashing the whites who were conquering the Apaches. So I guess I struck a balance if I offended people on both sides. Most people really liked the book, though, and responded to it the way you did.
You know, I appreciate the honesty out there because I just believe that we can't lose our history. If we lose our history, we lose who we are. I mean, I believe our history is who we are today, is why we're who we are. And it was refreshing to see that. You know, I'm going to throw a couple names out there, and I would like, well, one question I'd like to ask you is, when you came into this, who was somebody that maybe attracted you more than you thought you were going to be attracted to? And then maybe who was a character that you stumbled into that you maybe thought was maybe a certain way, but it wasn't the way you thought?
Well, certainly I was fascinated by Mickey Free, the young boy whose kidnapping sets off the Apache Wars. And of course, the Americans hadn't fought the Apaches because the Americans came so late to the Southwest, but the Apaches had been fighting the Spanish and then the Mexicans for hundreds of years, in fact, by the time of the American conquest in 1848. And so Mickey Free was going to be my main character, and he was the one I was most excited about. But as I worked on the book, as I researched the book, I discovered that, there just isn't enough on Mickey Free to make him, you know, totally a through character. So I had to develop other characters as well in the book. And obviously Geronimo is a major character in the book, as he would be in any story of the Apache Wars. But Cochise, Tom Jeffords, General George Crook is someone who I came to believe was highly overrated in history. And certainly I thought botched the Apache Wars. And of course he got fired because of his actions. And already on the Northern Plains, of course, he had not done well either in the Great Sioux War when Custer was wiped out. So I was sort of prejudiced against him, but I was really struck by his actions and the way he'd lied to the Apaches about what he could do for them when he knew full well that he couldn't make those promises come true. So they were, he's supposed to be their friend, but he actually betrayed them.
I tell you, anyone that Geronimo was afraid of, as I read, he was the only man he was afraid of was Mickey Free.
Mickey had this power, this ability as translator to kind of shape the story, and had control of the story. And Geronimo feared that. He feared that power. And he and Mickey obviously had some run-ins, and so there was some real tension there. And later on, Geronimo, who could spin a story too. And wasn't always truthful. Geronimo blamed everything on Mickey Free. Oh, I had to get off the reservation because Mickey Free was going to kill me. You know, here's the toughest Apache, the toughest Indian that ever lived. You know, and he's afraid of this, one-eyed white guy. I don't think so. But that certainly was the story he told, and that was kind of gave him cover for some of his shenanigans.
I tell you, the story of Mickey Free with the, you know, and again, I don't know if the history that I've read is 100% accurate, but the captor, somebody that he dealt with that was after he was put in captive, was missing an eye also. And that might have just saved him. I heard that.
Yeah. And he was a Mexican captive who had risen to be a leading Apache warrior. Beto was his name. And, it's probably why Mickey wasn't killed, because Mickey was kind of right at the age when he was kidnapped, 11, 12 years old, where it's more likely that he should have been killed, but maybe the single eye saved him from that fate. And he was carried off, and then he was sold, which often happened. And then he was gifted to someone as a present, and the family that he was gifted to, sort of adopted him. Well, and sort of, they did adopt him, and they brought him in and they raised him as an Apache. So here was this half Mexican, half white kid, half Irish kid who with red hair, one eye, who was an Apache. And he never could speak English very well. And his Spanish was really tortured, but he was fluent in several Apache dialects. So He was a very valuable character, and he's one of those great characters, and you find these often in the story of the American West. You know, the man caught between two worlds. Is he an Apache? Is he a white man? Where does his loyalty really lie? Well, in Mickey's case, I don't think he ever really knew. He just did the best he could in a sort of crazy world of constant and unrelenting change. And that's really the story of the West. You know, it's this incredible change that's going about. It's why it was so difficult for for Native peoples to have to deal with this whole period of exponential change. I mean, this is just a single generation, you know, from the end of the Civil War to 1900, and everything changes in the West. Everything changes, and their life ways, their culture, you know, their whole system of beliefs is sort of shattered by this onrush of change, and they had to adapt. Of course, those, you know, folks are still adapting.
You know, the Apaches never saw themselves as like this one group, right? They were more individuals. Is that accurate to say?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there is no, you know, Apache tribe. There were several, you know, different tribal groups, all of them who identified as Apaches, but there was no sense of real unity. And it took a very strong leader to unify the various bands, and they never were able to. Mangus Colorados did. He was probably the strongest, and then Cochise, you know, after him. And it was, you know, Cochise and Geronimo are Chiricahuas, and that was the largest, most prominent of the Apache groups. Mangus Colorados was a Mimbres from, you know, around Silver City, New Mexico, in the Gila Wilderness area. Cochise was from the Dragoon Mountains, you know, that area down in southeastern, you know, Arizona. And then there were the White Mountain Apaches, and that's where Mickey Free was raised. And the White Mountain people really never sided with the Mimbres and the Chiricahuas in their later conflicts with the army.
You know, one of the things that always kind of shocked me was that a lot of these Apaches was to go out and be scouts for the army. But when it was all said and done, it was time that, you know, they kind of wrapped it up. They all got put in the same place, you know, and I always thought that seemed funny.
Well, many of them did, but just the Chiricahuas. And it was indeed Chiricahua scouts. Chato was the most prominent, and he had been a great warrior with Geronimo, and then he became a scout for the army, and he was instrumental in bringing about the final surrender of Geronimo. And then he wound up, you know, on the same train heading to Florida, all the Chiricahua scouts, no matter what their service had been, were put on that were put on those trains and were sent to be banished in Florida, but the White Mountain Apaches weren't. And other Apache groups were not. It's just the Chiricahuas. And so the White Mountain Apaches, who were all scouts against the Chiricahuas, are still right there at Fort Apache in their homeland, which is in fact one of the most beautiful parts of Arizona. I always felt that the Whites had such contempt, the folks back east, of course, who have nothing, you know, but contempt for the West then, and I still feel that they still feel the same way. But they completely underestimated how great that land was up there in the White Mountains, and so they left the Apaches, what I think is the best part of Arizona. So good.
Oh, it's beautiful.
It is, yeah, beautiful. Good for the Apaches up there. Yeah. So it's just the Chiricahuas who get removed, and the Mimbres, who had been moved against their will, these were Victorio's people, had been moved against their will to San Carlos, and they were included with the Chiricahuas.
You know, I want to throw a couple of people's names at you, and I want you to give me your opinion. Lozen.
Excuse me, I've got
really bad
hay fever, so I have to drink. And actually, this is, I'll tell you, I've got ulcers. I've developed ulcers writing my new book. And so I'm drinking non-alcoholic beer. So it's pretty sad fate that I've fallen to here as a writer. You know, I've got that Hemingway thing. I think I've got to drink when I write. Well, I'm drinking Bud Zero. It's zero calories, zero alcohol. But it does semi-taste like beer. But back to Lozen. Very controversial character, and it's interesting. Robert Utley, who's a very famous historian of the American West, and has a new book out on Sitting Bull. In fact, that just won the Western Writers of America Spur Award. But Bob Utley had written a biography of Geronimo, and he completely dismissed the Lozen story and said it wasn't true at all. And that's because he had been listening to a great historian of the Apache Wars named Ed Sweeney. And Ed wrote really valuable books on the Apache Wars. And Ed dismissed the Lozen story as well. Well, I didn't. I embraced that story. I mean, partly because she's such a fabulous character, you know, the kind of book I was writing, how could I ignore her? But her story comes to us directly from the Apaches themselves and through their oral tradition and through the stories that they told white chroniclers. But nevertheless, her story, you know, comes from those people. And so you're going to dismiss the native voice if you dismiss Lozen, I felt. So I certainly included her. I would have liked to have done even more with her if I could have. Just a fascinating character. Of course, there's not much, on her. But certainly this warrior woman who fought side by side with Victoria is just absolutely fascinating. And she had a gift of visions, and so she could see the future. And this was vital to the people in terms of avoiding the troops and getting them out of trouble. And she was not with Victorio down at Tres Castillos, where he makes his incredibly heroic last stand. And otherwise, maybe he would have gotten away.
Victorio was the second person I was going to kind of throw into that mix, too. I was going to – it's the person that – didn't get it's not somebody that has a household name like a Geronimo or a Cochise, you know, Mangus, Colorado, not as much, but boy, very important leader.
He was, and he was the protege of Mangus. And he did try and keep the peace with the whites, and his people often, you know, are called Warm Springs people. And because of where they lived in New Mexico, kind of to the west of where Truth and our Consequences, New Mexico is today, where all those hot springs are. And there were hot springs up where Victoria lived too, Ojo Caliente. And there are several Ojo Calientes, of course, in New Mexico. And he tried to, you know, live with the whites. And of course, his reward for trying to keep the peace was to be removed with all of his people to San Carlos. The Department of the Interior, the civilians, wanted to consolidate all of the Indians on very few reservations so they could save costs in terms of supplying people. And they went to San Carlos, which, you know, it's near Globe, and I'm sure the citizens of Globe appreciate their community, but it is just a hellhole. I mean, just San Carlos at the time was just horrible. And it was not only that, it's before they dammed up the Gila, and it was kind of malaria ridden. There was a lot of bogs and swamps and all kinds of creepy crawly critters and insects. And the Apaches are, of course, a mountain people. And so you're taking them out of the mountains and you're bringing them down to this kind of these lowlands. And they just died. They just died by the scores. And so Victorio had no choice. He broke out. You know, he broke out from the reservation, and there was no negotiating with the Americans. And of course, they sent the army after him, and he defeated them over and over and over again. But finally, you know, thousands of troops pursued him into Mexico, and he was driven down into Mexico where he was trapped. That's a site I would love to visit, but you can't go there anymore because of the cartels and all the drug problems down there. But Victorio to me is one of the truly great chiefs and leaders of the Apache people. And he really ranks right there with Mangus, Colorados, and Cochise. I don't include Geronimo with them because Geronimo, it seems to me, in many cases, and I know he's a hero to his people and rightly so, and he's a hero to a lot of people. But he's kind of a Custer-like character. It was always about Geronimo, And his actions, of course, lead directly to the relocation of the Chiricahuas and the Warm Springs people, to Florida, then to Alabama, and finally to Oklahoma, where they were held until he died in 1909, and then they were allowed not to return to Arizona, but they were allowed to return down to the Mescalero Reservation, their cousins, the Mescaleros.
I mean, there's so many characters that are just so colorful. You know, Al Sieber, you know, that's a guy that just is another one of those characters that just, you know, what's your thoughts on Al?
Just an amazing character. And of course, he's kind of a Civil War hero. He's a young kid, you know, and goes off, fights in the Civil War, gets wounded badly at Gettysburg in the leg. And it's ironic because his other leg gets shot by the Apache Kid during the Apache Kid breakout. But Sieber became the chief of scouts for General Crook. He was highly regarded. And I kind of love the idea of Sieber because, you know, he is an immigrant. He's a German immigrant, and he probably had a German accent this whole time. And, you know, we think of him as kind of the grizzled old scout, and he's been played by a lot of, you know, great character actors. You know, Robert Duvall played him. John McIntyre played him. In the movies, you know, but he probably had a German accent, and a lot of people probably called him Dutch, you know, which is what they called everybody who was a German immigrant in those days. But he put together the Apache scouts, and he used the Apaches very effectively against Geronimo and Victorio. And probably when you think about the great scouts of the West, the real, you know, hardcore lifelong scouts. He's the man. Al Sieber is probably the greatest of the scouts. A wonderful biography of him by Dan Thrapp, who's a great historian of the Apache period, and well, just a great Western historian, not an academic, but he wrote a great biography of Al Sieber.
Yeah, and a lot of those guys are laid to rest at Globe, in the Globe Cemetery. It's kind of cool that you can kind of pitch all that and kind of make, you know, that's what's so awesome about this book. It's what's so awesome about the history is that, you know, you pinpoint these locations and the people, and they're so colorful, and you get into all these. Daniel Boone was your guy, right? That's the one that kind of started you on your journey. Is that correct?
Well, it's Davy Crockett.
Davy Crockett. Okay, not Daniel. But
interestingly, well, I love Daniel Boone too. And what's so fascinating about them is to, baby boomers such as myself, and I believe you're in the same same coterie. They're played on TV by the same actor, so a lot of people get confused whether Daniel Boone died in the Alamo or not. But Fez Parker played them both. First for Disney, and then, of course, on television, that long-running series. And he was great as both characters. And Daniel Boone is a major character. In fact, I'm writing about him right now. He's a major character of my new book. And he really is an absolutely fascinating character, sort of the American Moses who leads the people to the promised land. And he just was obsessed with Kentucky and obsessed with the West. Sacrifices so much. I mean, he loses two sons, a brother-in-law, and a brother in his sort of mania to settle Kentucky. And then when he finally does settle it, all the new settlers come in, and he had been involved in surveying the land and laying out land for people, and everyone started suing him. You know, it's like the first thing that happens once settlement comes to the West and it gets safe and all the fighting is over with is that scores and scores of lawyers, kind of like locusts, descend on the land. And they certainly did on Boone. And he said, to hell with you all. Davy Crockett, did the same thing. He says, you can all go to hell. I'm going to Texas. Well, Boone told everyone in Kentucky to go to hell, and he moved to Missouri, which was then Spanish territory. By that time, he was so famous, the Spanish gave him a land grant, which the Louisiana Purchase negated. And so he lost his land holdings even out in Missouri. But that's where he spent his last years. And that's actually where he spent the majority of his life. We think of him in Kentucky, of course, and those tough years of struggle. And he really was the glue that held the Kentucky settlements together and kept Kentucky going. So just a fabulous, fabulous character, the real deal, you know, the true pioneer who opened up that very first frontier.
Question that's kind of different. In your book, Apache Wars, if you could invite four people to a dinner party at your house, what four characters would you choose to have dinner with, and would you be armed?
Well, let's hope it would be a peaceful dinner. I'd love to. Yeah, wouldn't it be great to have met Tom Jeffords and Cochise, of course, Victorio, Lozen. I mean, those would just be great characters. I'm not sure about Mickey Free. I don't think he'd be, you know, that interested. I often think about that question, in fact, you know, if, one of the characters that fascinates me the most from the story of the West is Custer. And, you know, if you had dinner with Custer, you never get a word in edgewise. It'd just be Custer talking about himself, which might be fun for a while at least. But Davy Crockett, I think, would be fascinating, you know. And of course, he was a great humorist as well. So he would be a wonderful, character to have dinner with. I mean, I think only Benjamin Franklin might be better. Although Franklin would be more intimidating. So, yeah, I often think about that. Who would you like to have at that dinner party? You know, there used to be a TV show years ago. Steve Allen hosted it, and he had characters from history to dinner. And that was the premise of the show. It was very clever. Didn't last long.
Why was Jeffers and Cochise, why was their relationship so important?
Well, their relationship is what helps to bring an end to the first of the Apache Wars, the 10 years that Cochise fought the Americans after the incident with Mickey Free at Apache Pass. And Tom Jeffords was a scout. He was a mail rider, and he was trying to get the mail through Tucson. And he had connections with the Indians. He had been trading with them, with the Apaches for some time. But he still very boldly just rode into Cochise's stronghold. He didn't know exactly where it was, but he knew they would find him. And of course they did. And they took him to Cochise, who was so impressed by this man's courage that he decided to listen to him. And they established a friendship, kind of, you know, first just mutual respect that grew into a really warm friendship. Cochise was older. He may have even viewed Jeffords as something of a son, but that eventually led to Jeffords bringing General O. Howard, so-called Christian general, to meet with Cochise, and they made the peace that ended the first of the Apache Wars. Geronimo broke with that peace, and he refused to abide by that peace, and that was when he first, you know, became a renegade and went off with his followers, who never numbered very many, but certainly were loyal to him. And of course, there was a wonderful book by Elliot Arnold called Blood Brother that was written about the friendship of Cochise and Jeffords. And it was made into one of my all-time favorite movies with Jimmy Stewart, Broken Arrow, which then later was a television show during the big heyday of the Western. It's Michael Ansara, who was Syrian, played Cochise, and John Lupton played Tom Jeffords in that TV show. So they were very famous at one time. And the book Blood Brother was a big bestseller. And then the movie was a huge success. And in fact, it was the success of Broken Arrow, Delmer Daves directed it, that led to a whole flurry of Indian hero movies in the mid 1950s. Movies about Sitting Bull and Geronimo. There's another one called Tazas, Son of Cochise, with Rock Hudson as Taza. Jake Harold Nash playing Sitting Bull. Victor Mature played Crazy Horse. It was always white actors. You couldn't get a movie made if you didn't have a star. And so it was always white actors playing the protagonist.
I tell you, some of that stuff's just, it's fascinating just to be living in this history. I mean, you know, when we, I mean, in Phoenix, we're right in the middle of all this history. When we think of the Wild West, where it's right down the street, it's not so far away. You know, you're living in it, you're breathing it. And then when you read these books, I tell you, this is a great book. Anybody that is into any history at all, what a great book. I really appreciate it. It was awesome to read. And I just don't say that. To read a history book that is this much fun was really cool, and I appreciate it. So what do you have going on now? What's the new book?
Well, the new book is called The Undiscovered Country. Stole the title from Hamlet's soliloquy. You know, if you're going to steal a title, take it from the best, and that's Shakespeare. Although I think many young people think Undiscovered Country, wasn't that a Star Trek movie? Well, I guess it was. They took it from Shakespeare as well. Took their title from Shakespeare as well. I didn't know the Klingons, you know, loved Shakespeare as much as I do. But this actually comes from a film as well. I hate to admit all my youthful indiscretions of becoming fascinated, you know, with history through film. But in My Darling Clementine, John Ford's a great movie about the Earps and the Clantons and the OK Corral, Victor Mature plays a very beefy, very healthy looking Doc Holliday. And in it, he does Hamlet's soliloquy. And that so struck me when I saw it. And it just made me think about what that meant. And of course, it's about suicide. The undiscovered country is where we go next, you know, after we pass on. And it talks about, you know, the courage it takes to go there. Well, it just struck me as a perfect metaphor for the West, because the story of the American frontier is a story of incredible romance and glory, but also of dark tragedy and horror. And kind of like suicide. I mean, it was indeed the death of one way of life and the rise of another way of life. I mean, if the West isn't conquered, the United States doesn't become a continental nation, doesn't become a great power, doesn't stop the Nazis, doesn't stop the communists and win the Cold War. Since I actually believe that the United States has always been and still is a force for good in the world, I see this as a positive. And one of the questions I want to get at in The Undiscovered Country is, how can something that is so positive, how can it be built on so much tragedy, so much destruction, not only destruction of Native peoples, but also of the environment? I'm using seven protagonists to tell this story, and I'm going to try and weave it through their lives, kind of like I did in Apache Wars with the various lives that I used. And it's Daniel Boone, it's Davy Crockett, it's William Weatherford, also called Red Eagle, who was the chief of the Creek Indians in the Creek Indian Wars. It's Kit Carson. It's Mangus Colorados, Sitting Bull, and Buffalo Bill Cody. And so it begins with one massacre, the slaughter of Braddock's men on the Monongahela, which began the French and Indian War, which a war started by George Washington, of all people, as a young officer who blundered his way into starting that conflict. And then it's going to end at Wounded Knee with the murder of Sitting Bull. And then, of course, the massacre that follows right after that. And these characters are going to tell that story as we move through this period of history. And I think the story of the American West is the story of America. And I'm hoping that this book, which is kind of my dream book, will bring that history alive.
As a pandemic, does it help or does it hurt when you write? I mean, in theory, I would think it'd be great, but I can see it working the opposite just as well.
Stopped me dead in my tracks. Really did. Yeah. It just was it. And yeah, you would think, here I am, I can't leave the house. It really was a problem. Really. And I'm hoping that because I'm late, which is not unusual for authors, but I'm hoping my editors will understand. In fact, I corresponded with my editor, and he said he doesn't understand how anyone can get anything done in this environment. Well, I'm getting a lot of writing done, But there was a period there where, yeah, where I just couldn't write. You know, you were kind of, I think all of us were that way, kind of consumed with it, you know, anxious about it, worried about it. And so, especially those of us of a certain age who were a little bit more in jeopardy, you know, than other folks. So I tell my students, though, you know, we teach now via Zoom. Hopefully we'll be back in the classroom in the fall. But I tell them, well, you're living through one of the most fascinating and interesting periods in history. And pay attention. And as you see, living in a fascinating, interesting period of history isn't always a very nice thing. So I hope, you know, we come through this all right. I think we will. I don't know. I assume we'll be stronger. We'll be stronger for it. But I think the pandemic itself has kind of torn at the fabric of our society in a way that, you know, we have so many divisions, so many problems going on now. And they're not all the fault of one political party or another or one group or another. I think that the pandemic has put a level of tension into society that that has led to some of these problems. And, you know, that itself kind of explains what was going on in the American West, and especially with people like Geronimo and others who decided it was better, you know, Crazy Horse decided it's better to fight and die than to live like this. Well, they're living through a pandemic, this horrid pandemic, you know, these people that are coming. And there was a disease frontier that, you know, went ahead of the white invaders. And so they're kind of living through the same sort of tension, anxiousness, anxiety that we've all been, you know, living through the last year. And of course, it looks like it's still going to go on for a little while longer. So yes, it was kind of tough to write, surprisingly, during the pandemic.
Question about your process, if you don't mind. I'm just curious, did you got a certain time that you write, or is there any routine? Is there, you know, is it whenever? I mean, I'm just curious myself.
It's all routine. It's all habit. And although it's changed over time, and I write here, I'm sitting here at the dining room table. My children have not eaten a meal at a dining room table in their whole lifetime. And I write by hand on yellow pads. And there it is. And then my long-suffering wife types it. And then I do revise on the computer. And I'll rewrite on the computer. And although I rewrite on the yellow sheets the next day, I always go back and rewrite what I wrote the day before. And I used to always write at night. I couldn't start until 5 o'clock. It had to be dark. And then I would write, you know, when I was young, till 2-3 in the morning. And that worked for me for the longest time. And I always drank when I wrote. And so that put a finite time on. Eventually you're starting to do gibberish. Now I write late afternoon, early evening, and you know, I'm getting to a certain age where 9 o'clock, you know, I'm turning into a pumpkin, you know, so I can't do those late nights anymore. And I can write at any time if I'm up against it. You know, when I was up against the deadline on Apache Wars and I was doing revisions and things, I work all day. But I find that about 4 hours is the most that you can do, whether you're drinking or not. And now I'm not drinking. And so, but it's still about the same. And you're kind of mentally exhausted. You're getting hand cramps, which if you write with a pen like I do, by the end of 4 hours. I was reading about Larry McMurtry, who just passed away, of course, and he said he wrote in the mornings. He was always done by noon. I always admire people who can do that. I can't even function, you know, till about noon. But he would write 5 pages, no more, no less. And that's it, every day of his life. Well, my goodness. You know, my students all say, oh, how do you ever write a book? Well, I, You know, if you write one page a day, that's 365 pages. I mean, for heaven's sake, you know, you just, the way you write is you sit down and you write. You sit. But there's a flow to it. You know, there's a rhythm to it. And I try to construct sentences with rhythm. I mean, there really is a kind of logic to it. And I rework sentences over and over, and I agonize over every word. That's why authors go nuts, you know, with a real tough editor who wants to kind of change stuff, you know. And so it's very intense work. And I suppose that's why you ask about the pandemic and its effect. That's why that distraction made it difficult to write, you know, because you were thinking about so many other things, worried about so many other things. It was tough to focus. And of course it requires intense focus. And once I start, I can't leave. I mean, I've got to do it every day. Can't take a break. I take a break, then it's 2-3 days, you know, to get back into it. And it's a failing on my part. I realize that, but nevertheless, it's just the way it is. So yeah, it's totally routine. There's a real routine to it and a real discipline to it. And the great writers must have just incredible discipline. I don't know how they do it. I've reached a point in life where I think back, oh my goodness, if I'd only had a little more discipline, I could have written 5 more books, you know. But I'll be satisfied with what I get to.
Do you know where the story's going? Do you know the end when you start?
Yes, of course. Well, especially when you're writing history, I mean, you do know how it's going to end. And again, on this book, on Undiscovered Country, I wrote a 50-page proposal, and I broke it down by chapters. I listed every chapter. I wrote a paragraph on what was going to be in every chapter. And is it going to be that way at the end? No. No. So I knew where I'm going to start. I know how I'm going to end. I know what the theme is, you know, or the themes that I want to run through the story. But you totally go off, and the story takes control of you in a real way. And especially when you're trying to write literary history, which is what I've tried to write, the story takes control of you. For instance, in this early part of my story, I'm in the American Revolution now, and George Washington has become a major character. George Washington wasn't even a thought when I wrote my proposal. He wasn't going to be a major character in my book, but he became a major character. And I'm comparing the land speculators, the big land speculators, and their interests in the West with the Daniel Boone pioneers. And both of them actually kind of come together at a critical moment in history, right when the revolution is starting, but from very different perspectives. And so George Washington has become a major character in my book. And I've been doing a lot of reading about George Washington, and I must say, I admire him even more than I did before. So,
well, that's what's amazing about reading any literature, any book, is that you find that character, you find that person, or you find something that just changes your thought process and takes me down that wormhole, whether it be Little Stephen, a guy I'd never even heard about, you know, that other than maybe one of the members of Bruce Springsteen, that no, he's this character that wandered throughout the Southwest, the original. And I love that, but it's like, how did I miss that? Or did we miss that?
Yeah, and I'm great at going down wormholes, let me tell you. It's scary. And then what's really scary in the writing process is sometimes, you know, these are some of your favorite characters and it all gets cut. You know, you've got to, you know, I tend to write long, and so then I have to cut out some of my favorite parts. So I've still got some chapters from Apache Wars that I had to cut out entirely, and they're going in Undiscovered Country. So I've got a little head start there on the middle part of my book.
How far are we away from the new book, you think?
I promised it. My new deadline was April. And I think I'm hoping for August.
Okay.
Before school starts. And I'm making good progress. So it's not impossible. So,
well, please come back when you're there, or even come back and hang out with us. One thing about us is we all love history and I like the fact when it's not dry, and I like the fact that, you know, we're a little crazy on this channel. I mean, we're a little fun. We have fun with it, and it's been awesome getting to meet you. I appreciate your time so much. Everybody out there, please go buy this book. It is awesome. I tell you, you will not be disappointed in it. It is absolutely. And, you know, I read a lot of books, and there's very few books that I've been this impressed with. And thank you very much. I just want to thank you for coming on. I appreciate you, and please come back.
Well, thank you for having me, and thanks for the great questions. You really made me think about some things. So I've enjoyed this very much.
Well, thank you. I'm going to let you go, because about an hour is all anybody can do. So thank you again, and I hope to see you soon.
All right. My pleasure.
Thank you, sir. I tell you what, that was great. I appreciated having him on here. It was neat to have him be able to come on here, and I'm very serious. This book does not read like a history book. It reads like this novel, but you have to go, oh my gosh, this thing is incredible. And I tell you what, unbelievable. I can't wait to get him back on here. I just like to chat with him about, you know, stuff, right? Different things that, you know, as far as the history of the Southwest, whether it be in New Mexico or here in Arizona or Utah or wherever in the Southwest. But what a great time. I tell you what, I want to thank everybody for showing up tonight. It was an incredible night. Had a great time, and thanks again for everybody that's been donating and keeping the channel alive, and you guys are awesome. And we will see you again on Saturday. We're going to have a strange show on Saturday, so you're going to want to be there. We might change the time to 8:00, but I appreciate you guys, and thank you very much. Have a great evening, and we're going to take it out of here. And have a great day. Thanks again.